Well, let's turn to the book of Esther, and let's go to the first chapter. I enjoyed listening to Rabbi Chaim Miller's insights on the book of Esther. In fact, I'm holding his new book, which is the book of Esther. It's in Hebrew and English, and then it's got commentaries by the great rabbis. It's been a delight to read. But he said something in his little 15-minute teaching on the internet that really got me thinking and thinking and thinking. So I'm going to share with you some of the things that I discovered as I came through the book. Well, in the first chapter, let's start with verse 1. Esther 1:1. This took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from Hodu to Cush. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he made a banquet for all his ministers and servants, the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and the provincial ministers being present, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were complete, the king made a banquet for 7 days. You'd think a 180-day party would have been enough, but he had another 7-day banquet on top. For all the people found in Shushan, the capital, great and small alike, in the courtyard of the king's palace garden, with white, green, and blue hangings, embroidered with cords of linen and purple wool on silver rods. Oh, and marble columns, couches of gold and silver on a floor of alabaster, and marble in rows and circles. Drinks were served in golden vessels, each of the vessels differing from all the other vessels. And royal wine was in abundance, according to the king's means. And the question is, who cares? All these details. Who cares what the floor was made out of, and the pillars, and the curtain rods, and the curtains, and the drinking vessels? Who cares? Nowhere do you find, anywhere else in the Bible, this kind of mundane, dreary, dull detail. Why are we inundated with detail here in the opening of the book of Esther? You know, in the book of Esther, God's name is not mentioned. And Esther almost did not make it into the canon of Scripture because of that. But there's no question about it that throughout Esther you see God's hand at work, even though his name is not openly mentioned. And the secret of the book of Esther, the thing that God would teach us in Esther, is the fact that he hides himself. In fact, the word Esther means hidden. There's the word Esther in Hebrew, and it means hidden. You'd think the book might be called Mordecai. Let's not name Mordecai, whose name comes from actually the god Marduk, for best commentaries say. But it's not named Ahasuerus, thank goodness, because nobody could say it. It's named Esther, which means hidden. And in the word, in Isaiah 45, Isaiah states, "Truly you are a God who hides himself." And the question is, why? And this word Esther comes from the last three letters of the word, the Samech Tav Resh, Sater, which means to hide. And you find this word in a number of different places in Scripture. Deuteronomy 29:29 states that the hidden things are for Adonai our God, but the revealed things are for our children, for us and our children forever. And the word hidden things is again the word Sater. Psalm 91:1. He who dwells in the refuge of the Most High. That word for refuge, are a lot of different words in Hebrew for a refuge or protecting barrier. But the one there is Sater, the hidden place, the hiding place. And why is God hiding? That's the question. And I came up with several reasons, but I want us to do a little history lesson. In the Garden of Eden, God didn't hide. In fact, he walked with Adam and Eve in the cool of the evening in the garden. He was known openly. There were no barriers between man and God. That's what normalcy is, by the way. That's what normal life is. That's what it was when God created man and placed him in the garden. That's what it's going to be in the kingdom to come. But this time in between, not normal. If you feel out of place in this life, well, good. Good, because this isn't normal. This is not the way things are supposed to be. I believe that the one time where it states that Yeshua wept, you know, Jesus wept. Well, there actually are a couple times. One is when he was riding into Jerusalem on the back of the donkey. And he wept over Jerusalem because he realized he'd be rejected. That's not normal. And then at the death of Lazarus, Yeshua wept. Why? He was going to resurrect him in just a few minutes. Why weep? I think it's because this isn't normal. Man was not designed to die. This is completely outside of normal. But in the world to come, when things return to normal, God will wipe away every tear. Because now things are back the way they're supposed to be. So if you feel out of place in this world, good. You're supposed to. If you feel perfectly at home in this world, something's wrong with you. Because this is not the way things are supposed to be. So when Adam sinned, when Adam and Eve sinned, he hid himself from them. He sent them out of the garden. He placed the cherubim there with the ever-turning sword to protect the way of the tree of life. And he's pretty much not seen again after that. He's heard from. And he'll make a little visits, and his word will manifest itself, and his word became flesh and dwelt among us for about 33 years. But those are exceptions to the rule, and even Yeshua said, it's imperative for you that I go away. Until things are normal, God stays in hiding. You kind of follow what I'm saying? And when God went into hiding, at that point, man began to earn his bread by the sweat of his face. That word, the sweat, is kind of an interesting word. It's the word zear, zeah, sweat. It's the only place it's found in scriptures, right there in Genesis 3:19. But it's the root of another word that's found, half a dozen times through the Bible. And that word means terror, horror, you know, the kind of scare where you're just shaking. Why? It's because we live in a world where horror and terror and fear are normal, whereas we were not designed for that. And one of the things that causes this constant kind of horror and fear is the fact that, well, we know we're going to die. We just don't know when or how. It's like Woody Allen said, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens. Yeah. But also, constantly, every day is a struggle. This is a world of struggle and of striving. That's what we were born into. And one of the things that makes this day-to-day life here such a pain is that we are inundated with details, dull, mundane, irritating details that eat up our time and our energy and details. I mean, just think about it. Probably already this morning, how many details have you had to see to? Where are my shoes? Why did the shoelace break? How did this get scuffed up? Why does my shoulder hurt so bad? Where are the car keys? Oh, I need to change the oil soon. Oh, it's a bad hair day. Where's the comb? I mean, it goes on and on and on. You don't even think about it. But you're inundated with details, just like this first chapter of Esther is, because God hides behind all this. The details are a distraction from reality. And he's a God who hides himself. And there's some very good reasons why he does. And so I put together some of these as I was thinking about it. I put together some reasons why it's important that in this life God hides himself. The first one, so that we may have free will. And I've shared with you before, there are three things God created so that we would have free will. One is the creation. He hides right behind this thin veil of the creation. It hides him from our sight. Because after all, if you could look up when you're getting ready to do something wrong, you see God just looking right at you. He's giving you the hairy eyeball. You could see him watching you. Or when you get ready to speed through Mogador, he appears in the passenger seat. He's just looking at you. You wouldn't do anything wrong. The other thing, two things he invented were time. Time is simply a delay between an action and its consequences. Some people think they get away with sin. No, they don't. It's just that God's invented time, so here's the sin, and over here, somewhere down the road, are the consequences. They may be an hour later, a day later, they may be years later, but there's always going to be a consequence of that sin. Or some people, they do something right, and they expect something wonderful to happen right away. They expect gratitude and joy and, that was wonderful. And sometimes it's just misery, but the reward will come. But in between the action and the consequence is time. And the third thing God brought into being was the enemy, Satan. So that there's a choice B. You have God's choice, but to provide a choice B, you need Satan. He actually serves a purpose. And so, in the garden, as you look at the rebellion of Adam and Eve, God isn't right there in a tangible way. He's hidden somehow. Here's the enemy providing a suggestion that, you happy? You can be happier. And then there's time. God said, on the day you eat of this tree, you will die. Satan said, no, you won't. And they didn't. But then again, they did. What happened right at that moment was a separation from God. That's what death means. And later, hundreds of years later, there was a physical separation of soul and spirit. So they did die physically. So that we can have free will. This is really important. We chose to walk away from God. We must therefore choose to make our way back to him. It's through the will that we sin, and it must also be through our will that we make our way back and choose righteousness. Adam and Eve chose sin without truly seeing what it would be. We must choose God without truly seeing what that is going to be. They followed their flesh, their eyes, and their hearts into sin. So therefore, we must walk the wet path of the Spirit out of it. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about how man in his wisdom turned from God, knew not God. So it pleased God by the foolishness of preaching. In other words, the foolishness of the evangel, the gospel, to bring us back to righteousness. Because you see, the message of God doesn't make any logical sense. Let's be really honest. That I have to believe that this Jewish carpenter who lived in Israel from Nazareth, that somehow he was God's son and he was sinless, and that he was executed by his own people, the ones who were supposedly looking for him, and that 3 days later he rose from the dead and then ascended. And somehow, if I make him my rabbi, somehow if I decide to cast my lot in with him and follow him and give my life to him, that I too will have life? Let's face it, folks, that's a tall one. And yet, when we hear that story, something deep, deep within us leaps and says, yes, that is it. That is it. What is that thing? What's that connection, that deep calling to deep? That is not your logic, it's not your eyes, it's not anything physical, it's something deep in your spirit. That one part of Adam and Eve that did not respond to Satan is the one part of you that must respond to Messiah. Satan works from the outside in, so God works from the inside out. All right? So it was important for God to hide himself so that we can exercise free will. Adam and Eve chose sin. They chose Satan's way completely based upon faith. in a lie. We must also exercise faith, but this time not in the voice of the serpent, but in the Word of God. Here's a second one to teach us what is real. To teach us what is real. You see, this world, when we come into it, feels like it's all there is. As a little child, this world is so real to us. And it's just, we love the toys and the play and the sunshine and running. We just engage the world physically. But as we grow up, the satisfactionist world begins to fade and fade and fade and fade and fade. And hopefully, as we mature, begin to realize that the unseen world is the world that's truly real. For as Paul says, the things that are seen are temporal, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Now, there's this wonderful illustration from the Talmud. And in this illustration, it's from Tractate Tanit. And there it is. The rabbis are discussing a passage in Deuteronomy 28:8. Where it says God will command the blessing upon you in your silos, your granaries. And so the rabbis have seen that God, when we're walking according to his truth, according to his will instead of our own, according to his word instead of what the world says, that God will bless our granaries. He'll fill our granaries. He'll bless us with rain and abundance. And they've turned this into a thing where that before they go to the granary, where all the grain is hidden, they say a blessing before they take grain out. And so here's the discussion. Rabbi Yitzhak said, blessing is not found except in something that is hidden from the eye. As it is said, Adonai shall command the blessing upon you in your silos, in your granaries. A commentary was taught in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael. Blessing is not found except in something at which the eye cannot gaze. As it is said, Adonai shall command the blessing upon you in your hidden storage places. Now listen to what they say. It says, blessing is not found in something that has been weighed, nor in something that has been measured, nor in something that has been counted. It is only found in something that is hidden from the eye. You know, if you ask people, if you make a circle, and you ask people, what is it you really want? Okay? And around this circle, you put the things. I need a car. I'd like my house paid off. I need more money. I like to find the right woman. Or I like to find the right guy. I'd like to be better looking. I'd like to be popular. I want to be famous. Blah, 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 blah. You put all these things in there. And then you take them one at a time. And you reduce it down to what is it you really want. Well, I want fame. Why do you want fame? So people would like me. What do you mean you want people to like you? I want to be accepted and admired by people. Oh, you want admiration. Okay, admiration. Let's put that in the circle now. Now, why do you want money? Well, so I don't have to worry. So in other words, you want delivered from worry and fear. Yes, yes, I want confidence in the future. I want hope and confidence. I want a sense of security. Oh, well, let's put that now in the circle. Because all these things outside the circle is just the stuff. What's inside the circle is a true motive for wanting the stuff. And if you take anything it is you want right now, you keep reducing yourself and asking, why do I want that? Why do I want that? Why do I want that? It always comes down to something invisible. Always, every single time, without fail. It always comes down to something invisible. Something you can't buy with money. You can't find the shelf of Walmart. You can't order off Amazon. It always comes down to something invisible. And that's what the rabbis are saying. Blessing does not come from the physical things. They may be a vehicle of blessing. Someone may give you a gift, but the reason that gift is so precious to you is not the thing itself so much as the heart of the person who gave it to you. That's why you take that picture your kindergartner painted with hand paint, you put it on the refrigerator. It's not because the picture is so great. It isn't. It's the loving heart of that child. And that's why you'll keep that picture sometimes for years and then show it to your grandchildren someday. You know, the wedding ring my wife gave me 31 years ago. You know, it's a lot more precious today. It was a year or two ago, that's for sure. But it's not that I couldn't replace this ring. It's not that I couldn't find one maybe looks better. But this is the ring that she chose, that we went together to pick. And this reminds me of a day that just can't be replaced. It's the person behind this ring that makes this ring precious, not the gold itself. You follow what I'm saying? So it's from the invisible realm that real blessing comes, satisfaction comes, joy, light. Everything you want comes from there. So one of the reasons God hides himself is because we'll not only seek him, but we'll seek that entire kingdom that is part of him. And we'll begin to realize our ways always fail. And eventually, we should get sick of doing things our own way. You know, when people come to me and they have problems and whatever, and they want counsel and help, one of the first questions I'll ask them, well, you tired of doing things your own way yet? And sometimes they're not. So we have a very short counseling session. Come back when you're tired of doing things your way. Then we'll talk. But most of the time, people are fed up with their own way because their ways are a way of death. Their ways are death ways. There's a way it seems right to a man, but the end thereof is a death way. So when you get sick of doing things your own way, let's talk. And let's begin to pick up God's word, follow his counsel for the right way. And then we begin to discover a growing hope and a joy and a richness and a texture to life that does not come from this world. All right? The third thing, to develop in us a yearning for him and his kingdom. To develop in us a yearning for him and his kingdom. I'm going to read an excerpt from one of the ancient writings of Israel, what's sometimes referred to as the deeper sources. But it's a wonderful story. You've probably heard it. It's pretty well known. It talks about how a person, a soul of a human being, can long for something that's at a distance. It's locked away. It says, this may be compared to a beloved maiden, beautiful in form and appearance, concealed secretly in her palace. Get the picture? The maiden is concealed, locked away from you in her palace. But she has a single lover unknown to anyone. That single lover is you and me, by the way. Unknown to anyone except to her, hiddenly. Out of the love that he feels for her, this lover passes by her gate constantly, lifting his eyes to every side, knowing that her lover is constantly circling her gate. What does she do? She opens a little window in that secret place where she is, reveals her face to her lover, and quickly withdraws, concealing herself again. None of those near the lover sees or notices, only the lover. And his inner being and heart and soul follow her. He knows that out of love for him, she revealed herself for a moment to arouse his love. This is a wonderful illustration, and what it's talking about here is that there's something in our heart that hungers for something that's closed off to us right now. For a time, it's behind the wall. It's on the other side of this mask of creation. It's hidden away. Now you think, well, wait a minute. Aren't we the bride? Isn't God the groom? Why isn't it the guy that's locked away in the palace and the woman who's walking around? Well, they explain this as well. You see, the word Torah has a feminine ending. The word chokmah, wisdom, has a feminine ending. The word Shekinah, which is the most manifest of God's manifestations. Feminine ending. It's always referred to as a her. And so this woman in the palace represents these things of God that our soul, nephesh, which is masculine, loves and hungers and desires so strongly. See, whoever's doing the seeking is considered to be the masculine. And the one being sought is always considered to be the feminine. Now, there's God sent Messiah to seek and to save that which is lost. He came as a man. And we are considered the bride. He came to seek us. But then we're in this divine game of hide and seek. He hides and we seek him. And he says, you'll find me when you seek me with all your heart. And so in this case, God's wisdom, his Torah, his revelation of himself is this beautiful woman who's locked away from us and our heart longs to be with her. Just as dying to. And once in a while, the window is open, she reveals her face to her lover and arouses love within him, but then closes the door. I think we've all probably experienced these moments where that heartache for the world after this one, just like, oh, I'm just tired of this place and this life. And like Paul, we say, you know, whether I live or die, it's all the same to me. Because if I live, I can continue working, serving, but to die, I can go be with him. So, you know, Lord, whatever, we're just in your time. But we've all had these experiences, hopefully, where you're studying the Word, you're disciplining yourself to spend time in it and to pray. And then once in a while, there's like this connection that takes place. It's just for a moment. It's like everything's illuminated for you. And you kind of lay hold of God for a moment. And the reality of who he is and how much he loves you just floods your heart. And then it's over. But that's enough. That's enough to hold you on to next time as you continue to circle the gate. You know what I'm saying? The fourth, to deliver us from pride and our fear of death. No, pride and fear of death are intertwined. They're like two wings on the same bird. Humble person doesn't fear death. The proud person does. Because if the proud person, everything's based on the flesh and this, what my accomplishments, and when I die, it's all gone. The humble person isn't like that. This is why I believe it says there in 1 John that all that is in the world, 1 John 2, 16-17, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Notice how he puts them all together? To deliver us from pride and fear of death. Is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passes away, and the lust thereof, and he that does the will of God abides forever. There's this passage I want to read to you from another rabbi. This is a living rabbi. And you'd think I'd put my pages in order so I could find things faster. How'd they get so out of order, though? Okay, there's the first page back here. I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs. It says, Paradoxically, as soon as we strive to reach the Creator, to perceive Him, to come closer to Him, we feel our yearning for the Creator vanish, disappear. How many of you experience this? When you first came to God, when you first began to live for Him, you're just so filled with zeal and joy, and life was good and happy, everything had the glow to it. But over a short period of time, those feelings went away. And then that's what separates the men from the boys. Those who are going to serve God because He's God, because they love Him, or the ones who are going to serve Him because it makes them feel good. See, the first ones are true servants. The second group are basically idolaters. What they're serving is their feelings about God. What I'm really pursuing is my good feeling about Him. Not Him. He's just a vehicle. He's just a vehicle to make me feel good. And when He quits making me feel good, I'll go find something else that makes me feel good. This is the problem I have with the extreme expressions in the charismatic movement. I'm not against charismatic things at all. I was a part of a charismatic church, Rob and I, for 13 years. But there's an extreme expression to where it's not about God at all. They just talk about God and they go there to gather and claim to pray to God just so they can get all emotionally worked up. It's like high school kids. They go to the football game not because they care about football. They just like to scream and yell and jump up and down and act foolish. Whether they win or lose, it's just, we're having a great time. So anyways, paradoxically, as soon as we strive to reach the Creator, to perceive Him, to come closer to Him, we feel our yearning for the Creator vanish, disappear. But if the Creator directs all of our sensations, why then does He specifically dissolve this yearning in those who desire to perceive Him? And not only that, why does He put all possible manner of obstacles in our path? Those of us who attempt to come closer are often met with His rejection. In fact, what he's saying is we feel like we're being rejected. We're working so hard, we feel like he's not responding. Indeed, He may even inflict years of suffering on those who seek Him. This is an excellent question. But then he goes on. Any work, any exertion of effort, and any praying is possible only if the Creator is concealed from human beings. A genuine prayer asks the Creator to grant one the strength to counter his own ego with closed eyes, without the Creator revealing Himself to the person, since this is the highest reward. Our level of spirituality is defined by our willingness to proceed selflessly. You see, anything you do for God because it makes you look better, because it makes you feel good, because it somehow pads your ego, guess what? It's not about God at all. That's called a religious spirit. And there's a world of difference between a person who is spiritual and a person who has a religious spirit. A person who is spiritual is one whose heart is in tune with the heart of God. One who is religious is one's only concern about, what do I look like? I want to put on the uniform. I want to plug into the group. I want to learn the words. I want to plug in and be a part of this particular group and do things right so I'm accepted. It's all external. And so God will not allow us to feel those warm fuzzies all the time because He wants us to learn faithfulness. He wants us to pursue Him out of love for Him, like the young man circling the gate of the palace of his beloved. And then I'll finish with this last bit. Until we begin to measure all of our actions and thoughts against the desires of the Creator, we're actually measuring all the actions against the desires of others who impose their will upon us, thus defining our thoughts and actions. Never are we free to act on our own. Either we are influenced by others who determine our behavior and actions, or our thoughts and actions are dictated by the will of the Creator. Never can we act in absolute freedom. The concealment of the Creator from us is done for our own benefit. Just as in our own world, every object not fully explored attracts us more than an object thoroughly examined. Isn't that true? How many bits of junk do you have sitting around your house you plan to put in the next yard sale? But when you bought it, you ordered it, you saw the package on the shelf, and there's something inside you, I want to know what's in the package. I want to know what it's like to own and hold that and use it and listen to it and play with it or do whatever. It was the unknown that attracted you to that thing, but once it was known, it's like, next yard sale. You know what I mean? Just as in our own world, every object not fully explored attracts us more than an object thoroughly examined, so the veiling of the spiritual world is indispensable to induce us to heighten our desire to nurture a sense of importance of attaining the understanding of the spiritual world. Do you understand God's wisdom and why He hides Himself? He wants to develop a longing within us. He wants to deliver us from pride. He wants to deliver us from a fear of death until we realize that death, though it's not something we're just can't wait for, but it's something that when it comes, it's the next door we go through. We don't rush it. We don't hurry it. God forbid. But when it comes, we do not fear it because it's the next stage in our development. It's the next step. And so, bringing this back around to Esther. Esther means hidden. And this book God has hidden. His name is not found in the book, at least on the surface. Although his name is found four times under the surface. And if we have time, we'll take a look at that. But everything about Esther is hidden. And how does God hide? He hides behind this flood, this tsunami of details. That's how the book opens. And that's how God hides in your life. All the nagging little distractions you meet with every single day. The temptation is to reduce your faith in God. God, if you are real, how come I have a headache today? Why do I have to put contacts in or polish my glasses, wear glasses at all, put air in my tires, pump gas, search for change under the couch cushions? Why do I have to do this? Why do I show up at the grocery store and I forgot left my coupons at home? Why? You know, it goes on and on and on. You go to put on, you're all dressed, getting ready to go to work, you realize a button's missing. Your zipper's broken. It never ends. What's this all about? If God runs the world, can he pay more attention to the details, you know? But that's just the thing, the details, which oftentimes control your will, control the things you have to do, this tyranny of the urgent around you. This is what God's hiding behind. He's there the whole time. He is there the whole time. You know, every one of these little details is a test. Every one of them is a test. How are you responding to it? You being overpowered by it? Or are you continuing to rejoice as you go through it? And you know, a lot of the details in our lives, as we live in a Western prosperous society like we do, we are flooded with things that we own. There's this burden of ownership. You know, instead of having one computer, we have half a dozen. Then when one of them goes down, we're just irritated. You know, when this thing doesn't work or that thing doesn't work and blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on. We just get irritated and burdened down. And so I think God's calling us back to simplicity. He's calling Robin back to simplicity. He hasn't got around to me yet. But anyways, you know, information, how we're flooded with information. But God is hiding behind that. He's hiding right on the other side. Let me show you something. Go to Esther 2:7 for a moment. There's this little phrase in verse 7 that, again, is a secret that God is revealing to us. It's talking about Mordecai, and in this chapter, Esther comes on the scene, and it says of Mordecai, he was a foster father to Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter. So Mordecai and Esther are first cousins, for she had neither father nor mother. It's so easy to miss that little phrase. There it is. Hadassah, he, Esther. The word he means she. In Hebrew, when I teach Hebrew, I have this little saying in Hebrew, okay? And the Hebrew people know it. Who is he? He is she. Because the Hebrew word who means he. The Hebrew word he means she. So there's your little Hebrew lesson for the day, all right? Hadassah, she is Esther. Hadassah is her Hebrew name. Esther is her Gentile name. Just as all Jews, they have their Hebrew name, and then they have the name they use out here. Shaul, Saul, that's his Hebrew name. But in the Greek world, they knew him as Paulos, Paul. What does Hadassah mean? Well, the word Hadass means a myrtle. What is a myrtle? A tree? Is it a tree or a bush? It's a tree, isn't it? Myrtle tree? Tree. Yeah, thank you. Hadassah, on the other hand, has another meaning. It is sometimes used, the Hebrew people who study Hebrew words say that it also is connected to the word chadashah. Hadassah and chadashah. All you got to do is on that first letter, just connect the little opening. Zip, just bring that left leg all the way up to the top. It becomes kadasha. It's like a homonym. Kadasha, Brit Kadasha, means renewed. Brit Kadasha, renewed covenant, or New Testament. But Hadassah, that, now this is something I made up, this is what the Hebraists talk about, has the meaning of renewal. Renewal. And so you come to this little phrase buried in chapter 2, verse 7, Hadassah, he, Esther. Renewal is hidden. Isn't that amazing? Aren't we all hungering and thirsting for renewal? We're hungering for the day that this mortality puts on immortality. And that this world that's under a curse because it's always wearing down. And we enter the world that where there is no more curse, Revelation 21 says. Curse is done away. No more curse. Things don't run down. Things just continue to improve and get better. We're looking for that renewal. And that renewal is available to us, but it's hidden. It's a hidden thing. Janet, see your hand up. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So tree of death kind of becomes a tree of life for us, doesn't it? Speaking of Messiah and his death, I want you to think about this. You know, we just finished Exodus in our weekly readings, our parasha readings here a couple weeks ago. And almost the whole last half of Exodus is all about the tabernacle. Because, you know, in the garden, God and man are separated. But God's been wanting to repair that distance. And so as he deals with Israel's sins and they begin to put on righteousness, God begins to draw close to them as well. And he gives them instruction for building a tabernacle. And he shows the perfect pattern of this tabernacle on Sinai to Moses. And he tells Moses, you build it exactly to every detail that I showed you, according to the pattern I showed you on the mountain. So Moses gets the people, the artisans of Israel together, and they bring the materials and their skills, and they make this, and they do it exactly the right way. And then they see as God's presence in the form of a cloud descends into the tabernacle. But when he's in the tabernacle, he's still hidden. He's hidden in the Holy of Holies, and between the Holy of Holies and the holy place is this veil, right? And this veil still has two cherubim on it, just like the two cherubim there at the entrance of the Garden of Eden, protecting the way to the tree of life. And these two cherubim are there on the veil, but what's behind the veil? The Ark of the Covenant with two real cherubim there facing one another. So the veil reveals what it is also concealing. And when Yeshua died on the tree, it tells us in the temple that veil is torn in half from top to bottom. It cost Yeshua his life to remove the veil. But here's the secret. It cost you your life to go in now. He laid down his life to make the way open. But it costs you your life. You've got to lay down your ego and your pride and your way of doing things. You've got to let go of all that. You must choose instead to live according to the rules of the hidden realm, the rules of the kingdom of heaven, and to say no to yourself and to die to self to enter into the way that he's made for you. Because that's the reality. That's the reality in there. You know, we have a few minutes left. And I want to show you something. Hey, by the way, when you look at those four things that I put there, these are four themes you find in the book of Esther. And so for your homework, if you want to continue on a little bit more in the study, you can take those four things and see how those four themes play out in this book. But I do want us to turn to this. Go to chapter 4 for a moment. Chapter 4. At this point, Esther has been made the queen because of her beauty and charm. But wicked Haman has inspired this plot and had an edict written where on such and such a day, all the Jews, from the greatest to the least, are going to be wiped out, destroyed. And so, in verse 9, we'll start with verse 9. Hathach returned. And by the way, there's a tradition in Judaism that Hathach here is actually Daniel. Something to think about. I don't know if he is or not. But this is another name for him, they say. Hathach returned and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Esther gave orders to Hathach, telling him what to tell Mordecai. You see, Esther's inside the palace. Mordecai is outside the palace, and so they have to use this messenger to go back and forth. All the king's servants, verse 11, and even the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman who is not summoned comes to the king into the inner courtyard, the law is unequivocal. A penalty of death. Only if the king extends the golden scepter to him will his life be spared. But I have not been summoned to come to the king for 30 days. See, Mordecai had sent a messenger, said, Esther, you've got to go talk to the king. You've got to reason with him. You've got to ask him not to fulfill this edict to kill the Jews. And she's saying, but he hasn't summoned me. And if I go into his presence, he's in a bad mood. He doesn't not extend the scepter to me. They'll kill me on the spot. Listen to Mordecai's answer to her. Verse 12. When they told Esther's words to Mordecai, Mordecai instructed this reply to Esther. Don't imagine that you alone out of all the Jews will escape by being in the king's palace. What he's saying here is, listen, cuz, we're first cousins. And this whole edict was inspired in Haman because of me. So when they come after me and all the Jews, it won't be any secret that you're my first cousin. You're going to die too. But look at the next verse. Actually, Mordecai goes on, if you stay quiet now, the Jews will find relief and safety through a different route. Mordecai is saying, listen, God has made a covenant with us. He's not going to let us all be wiped out. So whether it's with you or without you, God's going to deliver. No question about it. While you and your father's household will be destroyed, because Haman is determined to kill me especially. And you're my first cousin. You're my closest kin. And then he says, and who knows? Perhaps the monarchy came your way precisely for this moment. You see, Esther had to choose. I can die in the service of God and my people, or I can die in fear of obeying God and protecting my people. So I might as well make my death count. That's the kind of choice every one of us has to make. You've got to die. Now, you're going to make your death count or not? Are you going to die because you just wore yourself out making money? You wore yourself out just seeking pleasure? Or because you invested your life living a holy life, a righteous life according to God's word, laying it down for others? Because your life only has significance to the degree you lay it down for other people anyway. The only way to truly serve God is by serving his images. Us were made in his image. Serving one another. So anyways, you're going to die. You can make it count. Or you can try to hold on to your life and then lose the whole thing. So your death doesn't matter because your life didn't either. Amazing, amazing picture. We have a Esther here. Well, I've got two things I can show you in the time we have left. I can show you the four places and the amazing way that God's name is revealed in Esther. Or I can show you this one, which I'm going to do anyway. All right. Forget it. I just usurped your free will right there for a moment. I've shared this several years back. And it's an amazing thing, but what you see here is a page from Esther. And this is the part over in chapter 7, I believe, where Haman's 10 sons, you know, the plot backfires. The book does have a happy ending, provided you're Jewish. Haman's 10 sons are hanged on the gallows that Haman had built for Mordecai. And it is chapter 9, I'm sorry, chapter 9. And what you see up here is chapter 9, verses 4 down through verse 12. And on the right-hand side, the way it's written kind of in an odd way here is because you have the 10 sons. You have each of them named. the 10 sons. So it's like Parshandata, Va'et, and then it gives the next son, Dathon, Va'et, and then it goes on, the son, and 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 the son. It goes right on down. Esther was written thousands of years ago. And it's always been copied exactly the same way. I wish I had a copy that did not have all the little vowel points on it so that you could see a little more clearly what I'm about to show you. But something that has stumped the rabbis and sages for all these thousands of years is the fact that there are some letters that are written kind of in an odd way. First of all, right down here in verse 10, you'll notice that this letter is written way oversized, an oversized vav. Okay? But as we go up, you'll find that over here in verse 6, there's a little letter, a little tav right there. And then as you go on down in verse 9, there's this little shin that's written up off the line right there. And then right over here, over here near in the same word where the large vav is, there's this little tiny zayin. It's right there, okay? It's the third letter in, a little tiny zayin. So you've got three small letters, and then you've got this one big honking vav right here. And the sages look at this, say, well, what does it mean? They don't have any idea. This is the way it was written. This is the way we copy it. And then in 1946, World War II is over. The Nuremberg trials are going on. And I just recently picked up a 2 or 3 DVD set, just original footage and documentary about the Nuremberg trials. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. And you see the world court established here in Nuremberg. The city has been pretty much bombed out during the war. And you see there all the war criminals, these Nazis, these uppity-ups in the Nazi regime. And there's probably 50 or 60 of them there. And they're trying them. They have the testimony come forth. And of these Nazis there, some were released because they truly weren't guilty of war crimes. Some were given short sentences, some longer sentences, life sentences. But 12 of them were condemned to death by hanging. 12 of them. One of them escaped. He managed an escape. He went to South America. And that one was named... which one was he? Eichmann, yes, correct. Eichmann escaped. Wonderful book is a book that was written in the 70s about how the Jewish commandos from Israel went down and they captured Eichmann in South America, brought him back to Israel, and they hanged him there. So now we're down to 11. Then the night before the hanging was to take place, Martin Bormann, who had a cyanide pill hidden in his belongings or in a tooth or something, he took the cyanide pill, he dies. So on the morning of the execution, there are 10 henchmen, Hitler's henchmen, and they're taken out one at a time and hanged. The last one to be hanged, his last name was Stryker, Julius Stryker. And Newsweek magazine on October 28, 1946 said, the last one to be hanged was Julius Stryker. As he was dragged to the gallows, he cried out, Purimfest, 1946. Now, it wasn't the right time of year. Purim takes place here in the springtime. This was in October. Stryker is not Jewish. What does he know about Purim? But Purimfest, Feast of Purim is what that means in German. Purimfest, he yells out. Purimfest, 1946, they pull the handle, he drops and dies. And this is reported in Newsweek. I believe that it was God's spirit speaking through the wicked lips of this wicked man. The last thing he said, he got right. Because immediately people went back to the book of Esther and thought, well, that's where 10 men are hanged. These are 10 sons of Haman, whereas here in 1946, it's 10 followers of Hitler. Both of them wanted to completely eradicate the Jewish people from the face of the earth. And they went back and they examined these letters. The Tav has numerical value of 400. It's the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet.
Shin is the next to last. It has a numerical value of 300. And then the little Zayin, we're taking the three little letters. Little Zayin equals 7. And when you add those up, you come up with 707.
Well, 1946 on the Hebrew calendar is the year 5,707. Okay? They count from the year they believe Adam was created. And so if you have a Hebrew calendar, it'll have the Hebrew number for the year, and then it'll have the Western year. So 1946 was 5,707. But how do they know which millennium? Oh, that's where this big Vav comes in. Vav has a numerical value of 6. So it's referring to the sixth millennium, which would be in the 5,000s, you see. So the large number tells us the millennium. The small numbers add up to the year. And when you put it all together, you have the sixth millennium, which would be in the year 5,000 plus 707. 5707 is 1946 on the Hebrew calendar. Now I want you to think of something for a moment. Put yourself in the shoes of a Holocaust survivor, or a family member, a Jewish person who escaped the Holocaust in some way. And you're thinking, where was God? Does God even exist? Where was he? How could he hide himself in our darkest hour? And then you pick up Newsweek magazine. You read the dying words of this rotten, miserable Nazi war criminal. You go back to the book of Esther, and you realize there that hidden in this book, thousands of years ago, was recorded the very year when Hitler's 10 henchmen would be hanged. And then you realize, from the days of Esther, God knew about World War II and Hitler and the Nazis and the Holocaust. And he put there the very year, because he knew the end from the beginning. Even though he was hidden, he was not absent. Even though he was hidden, he had not stepped off his throne. He was still running the world. And as I've always said, all pain is birth pain. Any pain in your life is birth pain. It's the process by which something new is about to come forth. Every pain, even the aches and pains in your body, are the birth pains of a resurrected body. And so probably one of the greatest pains in the collective memory and history of Israel is the Holocaust. And what was born out of that? The nation of Israel. There had been no Holocaust, there'd be no nation of Israel, at least not in the land of Israel. And so God was working from the very beginning. He had everything under control, even though he was so hidden from the lives of these people suffering. I hope the message comes through here. And if we had time, I'd show you where God's name is hidden four ways. It's fantastic to see how it works. But he's there. This is where faith comes in. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, right? So you live in according to the visible or according to the invisible. We have to undo what Adam and Eve did. They followed what was pleasant to their eyes, right? And good for food, flesh, desire to make one wise. And we've got to counter that by becoming humble, by desiring the things that may not be satisfying to the flesh, but to follow the voice of God. And as we do that, we'll begin to see him in a unique way, a very unique way. Adam, I see your hand up, and then we'll go to Jim. Yes, Adam. Right.
And part of me I see a lot of connection with that in her, of how we know what it is and then we know what we see what we're looking to. And it's almost, I know it's hazel.
Well, that's a great point to bring out. There's no more hilarious holiday on the calendar than Purim. In fact, since we have a pretty hilarious congregation, it gets to be very dangerous when we celebrate Purim together. So we only do it like every other year. But yeah, the book starts out with this, you know, it quickly develops into this thing where Jews are going to be eradicated, but it ends with this partying, this wonderful feast and joy. Yitzchak, laughter, is when you take two things that simply don't belong together and you put them together, and the incongruity of the two make you laugh. Every good joke in the world is made of two things that don't seem to belong. You stick them together, and it's funny. Like Robin and me. Whoever thought that up, you know, that sort of thing. So that's, and in fact, when Isaac, Yitzchak, laughter, when he told the fib about his wife being his sister, right? So Abimelech wouldn't get after him. It says Abimelech was looking out the window and he saw Yitzchaking with his wife, with Rebecca. Because the word for a man and woman coming together is also Yitzchak, laughter, because it's incongruous. These two opposite creatures coming together, and out of that comes life and joy. I mean, it's one of the primary foundational truths of Scripture. So, and of course, the great laughter is when this physical world and the heavenly world come together. Just read the last two chapters of Revelation. All the tears are wiped away. And I think a lot of those are going to be tears of joy. I mean, just like, this is going to be amazing. But anyways, Jim, you'll get me on a whole other sermon here.
In thinking of faith containing so much that we really can't see, when one starts to think, you know, fairly highly of himself for choosing right, to have faith, he has to remember that even the faith itself is a gift.
It is. Even the faith is a gift.
It goes on to make me wonder, perhaps our reactions are even more important than our actions themselves. You know, how we react.
It's all important, yeah. Good point. You know, you make me think of something here, which is the danger of raising your hand this late in the game. But I know most of you are aware of this, but the word truth in Hebrew is emet. It's spelled with aleph, mem, and tav. Aleph is the first letter of the alphabet. Tav is the last letter, the 22nd letter. And mem is right there in the middle. It's about number 14, 13. All right? So truth starts at the beginning, goes to the middle, and the end. Truth covers everything. You want a definition for truth? It's called reality. Which means most reality shows are not true. You know, it really isn't. It's just. But the word for faith, the root of faith, the faith is amunah, and the root for that is amen. And it's spelled aleph, mem, and then it goes one more letter. It just goes one more, and then you're done. And that's faith. What does this tell us? You know, part of this walk with God, you can follow, it's some of it's logical, you figure it out and you go, but there's a certain jumping off point that if you want to make it all the way to truth, if you truly want to walk out this life fully, completely to the very end, there's a certain point where you come to and then you kind of walk blind. There's a place where you have to, as the sages say, it's like walking in the dark, totally dark, then there's a lightning bolt, just for a second. Everything's illuminated, and then the light's gone out. And now you must walk in the memory of what you see and know to be true. Because right now it's not obvious. And that's what happens to every one of us. That's what the book of Esther is all about. Walking in truth when you can't see the next step. You don't know what's going to happen. The end is not revealed. You walk in amunah. Okay? Well, anyways, at that point, we really do need to close. I was going to say our subs are going to get cold, but they don't get cold. They're going to get warm. And so, again, I invite everyone to go down to the social hall, and we're going to have a little Purim fest of our own. And so we'll close in prayer. We'll have Ben do the blessing, and then we'll go down and eat. Our Father and our King, how we thank you for the wonder of your word. Lord, as we look into it, it becomes more and more evident to us that it is no human author who could come up with these things. But Lord, you have hidden yourself well. But the very thing you hide behind gives you away, because your creation proclaims you, and your word proclaims you even more. But Father, it was words from an enemy who led us into sin in this world, but now it's words from you, the living God, who leads us back to life. So Father, help us to walk in your words, according to your truth, even when we can't see it clearly. For the Lord to walk according to faith. And may you be pleased with that. For without faith, it's impossible to please you. So thank you again for this time together. We thank you for your word. We thank you for one another. We thank you for Messiah. And we thank you for another day of life, another gift from you. Help us to live it well. And we thank you for this holy Shabbat. B'Shem Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.